documentary.
I want to ask you a last question. Life Animated, is it going to be showing at the movie theater you work at?
Yep.
The Regal Cinema in Hyannis.
Yeah, when?
Well, who knows? Sometime soon, I hope.
That's what we're here to work on. This is a market, so we're here to sell the film, and hopefully it's going to be in Regal Cinema.
A celebration
Owen,
of cinema.
And Owen and his whole community.
So Owen, you're going to go from punching people's tickets to get into the showing of the film, and then you're going to go up on the stage afterwards?
Will that be fun?
It will be.
Well, I really appreciate you taking this time, and I wanted to ask, is there anything I forgot to ask you or that you'd like to say?
Hey, Owen, why don't you finish with your favorite line from Merlin? Go ahead, sit up straight.
You want to
do the one you did at your graduation?
Yeah. Knowledge and wisdom is the real power, boy.
Knowledge and wisdom
is the real power.
You bet.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Owen and Ron and Roger, thank you for being here, and thank you for a magnificent exploration of a life. And thank you, Owen, for sharing your life with all of us.
You're welcome.
That's Owen Susskind and his dad, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Susskind, and the Oscar-winning filmmaker Roger Ross Williams talking about their new documentary, Life Animated. It premiered here at the Sundance Film Festival. That does it for the show. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottes, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield, Marine Shake. Thank you to John Hamilton and Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 8:01. Democracy Now! Was brought to you by our station KBOO and our supporters, including this underwriting.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Coming up next, we have Talk Radio with host Paul Rowland and independent journalist Arun Gupta reporting from Harney County, Oregon, and the Malheur Wildlife Refuge on the occupation of the Bundy militia at that site. First, some messages, and then we'll welcome your calls at 503-231-8187. Stand by for the breaking news.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Religion for Life. I'm beginning a series called Islam 101, Meet Your Muslim Neighbor. I'll be talking with local Muslims in the Portland area, as well as Quranic scholars. This week, I speak with Ali Hadroj of the Islamic Center of Portland.
Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Eyes for Allah. Nothing but Allah. Ba is the beginning of Bismillah. Ta is for taqwa, the wearing of Allah.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running through February 8th. Thursday, January 28th, will screen Landfill Harmonic. Landfill Harmonic follows the Recycled Orchestra of Keitora, a Paraguayan musical group that plays instruments made entirely out of garbage. When their story goes viral, the orchestra is suddenly catapulted into the global spotlight. This 2014 film has been described as a testament to the transformative power of music and the resilience of the human spirit. That's January 28th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
A young cowboy named Billy Joe grew restless on the farm. A boy filled with wanderlust who really meant no harm. He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as quick and straight as anybody can. But I wouldn't shoot without a cause. I'd gun nobody down." But she cried again as he rolled away, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He sang a song as on he rode, his guns hung at his hips. He rode into a cattle town.
And we are live. Hey,
that's
Paul.
Johnny Cash. And I'm Paul Rowland, live from the Silver Spur Motel here in Burns, Oregon. And we played that song last week, kind of ironically. Now it's got kind of a sort of a bitter aftertaste since someone did lose their life yesterday. Leviticum. Actually, I'm not sure that's the name. But our guest will tell you all about him and other people that we met over the past week here at in Burns, or actually also 30 miles from here at the Wildlife Refuge, where we visited three times. The last time just yesterday, just about 5 hours before all this that probably most of you have heard about took place, where now five people, I believe, are in custody, including the two Bundy brothers and Ryan Payne, another key figure in this whole series of events. And so, yes, my guest is Arun Gupta, who was founder and editor of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. He's been a freelancer for The Nation, Washington Post, The Guardian, and Salon, and is currently on assignment for The Raw Story, a web-based news service. Hello, Arun.
Hi, Paul.
We're going to, it's going to be a little difficult. We're on two phones here in the same motel room, and we're occupying two lines of the KBU tried and true, but somewhat old-fashioned phone patch service. And so we're only going to have one line open for callers. So I beg and implore our callers to be as succinct and brief as possible. I know there's probably going to be a lot of people who want to ask about what we've seen and heard here while we've been here. So let's get this rolling. Again, the events are unfolding. We, strangely, ironically, we're on the same road. We're actually had been interviewing a member of the Committee of Safety here in Harney County, and we'll be talking about that some. And we're running a little late So perhaps if we'd been more on time, we would have actually been right in the middle of what happened, because we were on the same road, 395 north, through the Malheur National Forest, where this, I'm not sure exactly how the dynamic took place, but the state troopers overtook or had a roadblock or something of the car vehicle carrying the Bundy brothers and some of the other people. And this shootout took place, one person dead, Ryan Bundy injured, and all of them in custody. We came upon it just a few cars back. And Arun, just tell us, give us your overall impressions about of this past week, what you've learned about the Bundys, what some of your impressions were of being out there at the refuge.
Well, I think the big thing to understand is they were really trying to start a revolution. They kept talking about how we want to return to a constitutional form of government. We want to get back to the Constitution. Nearly everyone there would carry around a copy of the Constitution. They had all these pocket copies they were passing around, and I got one. But when you started to ask them what exactly did they mean by that, you know, it wasn't just what you often hear from the right wing, oh, we need to abolish the Department of Education, we need to abolish the EPA. They wanted to abolish virtually all of the federal executive branch, but they also wanted to return all lands and powers to local control. On top of that, you know, when you would ask them, well, which government in the U.S. do you see as being constitutional? It was not. There was not a single government down at the county, municipal level, much less the state or federal level, and they wanted to just completely sweep it all away. And it was, you know, they're Mormon, and there's a lot of religious motivation mixed up in this as well. I think they really were treating, they look at the Constitution as this sacred, almost holy document, and they were on a purification mission. And it was going to start in Harney County. You know, because they kept saying, one of the things they kept saying, they had these different demands going in, right? It started around these two ranchers, Dwight and Steve Hammond, who were convicted of arson on federal lands. And you have to understand about them, like, there are a lot of people here who say they got a bum deal. They were sentenced to 5 years for this arson. But there were many, many incidents before this, all sorts of illegal activities, death threats. So they were just kind of put away for something egregious that they could get them on. But nonetheless, that upset a lot of people here. And so that's why they were able to kind of find some support here. But they set up this thing called a Committee of Safety. And so when they kept saying, we want the lands to return to the people of Harney County, they weren't talking about the Harney County government. They were going to create their own new government, and it's all based on this mythologized notion of colonial America, this, like, rugged individualism and communities banding together. I mean, you know, it's very much as kind of like fire and brimstone teachers who, you know, say we need to go back to these old, like, Christian communities and, you know, get rid of all this modern apparatus and things that are distracting us. Another way I was describing it was kind of like year zero, that they wanted to restart society over, starting in that wildlife refuge in Harney County. And what happened last night is they were trying to expand. We can talk a little more about this, but I think, you know, their fatal flaw was that they were getting cocky, and two, at the same time, they were also, I think, getting a little desperate, and so they were trying to expand their campaign in various ways, take more territory, but also to set up another Committee of Safety, this time in neighboring Grant County, and that's when the feds sprung a trap for them. I mean, it wasn't very smart on their part to have the entire leadership going there. So the Feds sprung the trap, and they captured him, and Lavoie Finicum was shot and killed, and Ryan Payne was apparently wounded superficially. And I think seven others are now in jail, and there'll probably be more arrests.
Yeah, and there's a lot to go on here. Again, the number to call in is 503-231-8187. And as I mentioned at the outset, there is only one line open since both Arun and I are on separate phones calling in from Burns, Oregon, where we've been for the past week and following this very closely, interviewing people in the community. We interviewed Judge Steve Grasty. We interviewed a rancher. We interviewed Tim Smith of the local Harney County Committee of Safety. We interviewed Ryan Bundy. I think actually, Arun, you talked to Lavoie Finicum himself, the man who was unfortunately killed yesterday. And I'm not sure if details of the actual dynamic of how that came about are known at this point. Perhaps you can speak to that a little bit later. Get into that issue, of the Grant County, where they were going. I think that's a really key point that you've been making in your writings and some other interviews I've heard and in our conversations. That one thing I thought that the whole issue of the grazing fees, which is one of the kind of sparked this whole thing off. Both the Bundys in Nevada at their ranch refusing to pay grazing fees to the Bureau of Land Management. The Hammonds having constant conflicts with both the Bureau of Land Management and the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, partly over grazing fees. That Adrian Sewell, the rancher from Nevada, who very dramatically at a press conference at the refuge, or Bundy Land, as the Willamette Week put it, signing this kind of faux, as you pointed out, notarized document with a bunch of information left blank, so perhaps not even legal, if it could even be considered legal to begin with, renouncing his payment of grazing fees. So I almost see these grazing fees as kind of these people's stamp tax or tea tax, harking back to, their sort of mythologized reading of the events leading up to the American Revolution. And furthermore, I kind of see their view of the federal ownership of lands in the West as sort of really parallel to the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which my guest a couple weeks ago, Jacqueline Keeler, mentioned as being one of the major factors leading up to the American Revolution, which, of course, set this demarcation where American settlers or colonists, actually at the point, colonist settlers couldn't go beyond the crest of the Allegheny Mountains. Anyway, so all these kind of echoes of the past and these obviously committees of safety were hark back to groups that were set up after the American Revolution, where people felt like the federal control hadn't been consolidated, so there was really no protection, probably mostly from Native Americans. And so there's all these intense historical issues that really, I think, are a challenge to all of us to really understand our own history. These people, their skewed interpretations of the Constitution notwithstanding, they do have sort of this basis in some kind of history. And I don't know, maybe it's a challenge to a lot of us to really understand that. So, again, talk about this. Your view of this this meeting that was going to happen. I understand that actually maybe a couple hundred people I read were actually waiting there to hear these, their heroes, perhaps. Some people see them as coming from this dramatic occupation here, who, of course, were way late. Talk a little more about the sheriff of Grant County who's, has met with the Bundys, right?
Yeah, he had. Now, so the issue really isn't with the grazing fees. Adrian Sewell, who's he's from New Mexico, not Nevada. He refused to talk about how much he was paying to the Bureau of Land Management and National Forest Service to run 85 cattle. And so some journalists did a little digging, and they found basically it looked like he was paying $144 a month, which is just an absurdly low amount. According to how the BLM runs its program, the fees it gets doesn't even covers barely a third of the administration costs. And according to other analysis, if you want to, the BLM fees can be as little as 1/12 of what it costs to do on private land. More their issue is about the land management. So they're getting these incredibly subsidized fees. It's more about the land management. And, you know, we did talk to ranchers in Harney County who are on both sides of the issue, some supporters of the Bundys, others who, frankly, were pretty clear that they wouldn't mind seeing B-52s come in and take out the whole bunch of them. But they were all they are all worked up about how the lands are managed. They feel that essentially the BLM, National Forest Service, creates these conditions for these catastrophic fires. They've done very poor management of it, and they want more local control in that sense. So that's what's kind of spurring a lot of this. But behind that, though, is, as one rancher very explicitly put it to us, this is just all about economics, really, is what this boils down to, that throughout these western rural counties, towns and like Burns are dying. You know, they're losing population, schools are closing, jobs are going away, and what jobs there are paid, you know, just these poverty wages. The youth can't stay, you know, because by the time they get out of school, there's really no jobs for them. And so this is a very difficult question, you know, especially in an era of climate change, as to what should be done with these communities. Now, in Grant, the question is similar but different. It's about timber. In Harney County, it tends to be more about ranching, but in Grant County, but it's the same thing, you know, that they feel that they could be harvesting a lot of timber. And, you know, it's this poor management of the resources, quote unquote. And there are real issues with how the National Forest Service, one, it's often, I think, derided as the National Deforest Service because it does collude with the logging industry. But it's also engaged in this history of fire suppression that has led to these, fed into these catastrophic fires. But the issue is the same in terms of economic development. But, you know, as we're having conversations with these ranchers, you know, Harney County, there was, you go back to the 50s or 60s, there was like, you know, 10,000 people who lived there. There's only about 7,000 now. And this is a huge area. You know, people point out it's about the size of the state of Connecticut. So it's very sparsely populated. And there was something like 700-800 logging jobs or more at the peak. But even if you were to start to reopen this all to like significant exploitation of the timber, with just the incredible automation you have now, is how many jobs are you really going to create? Maybe it would be 100. It would probably be a stretch to say that you would even have 200 jobs. You're not going to be bringing back any sort of a vibrant community, and in the meantime, you're going to be exploiting. You're going to be adding to climate change. You know, and this is a far more important issue, I think. You know, but I don't think we should also pit the environment against jobs. Right? I think this has been a failure of the environmental movement. That if you don't figure out how to have some sort of meaning, social, economic development in these areas, the right wing is, and especially the extreme right wing, the white supremacists, the militias, they're all going to come in with the answers and tell them, here's what your problem is. And then you'll see things like this Bundy occupation. You'll see things like the Three Percenters, the Pacific Patriot Network, Oath Keepers, all these like radical right wing extremist movements will take root if the left, if the environmental movement doesn't come up with some sort of response.
So, Arun, I know you've got to go because you've got some other interviews. You know, you find yourself in a, you know, kind of the eye of the storm, as it were, here, covering this for the Raw story. I know you've been getting a lot of views for your coverage on the Raw story itself. Gets a lot of readership, and, you know, you've been having media requests, so you may have to cut out at some point. So I encourage people who do want to ask a question of Arun to call in right now. Ross, do we have any callers yet?
You know, Paul, right now we don't have any callers, but they can dial 503-231-8187 to talk to you and Arun. We do have one line open.
All right, so call that number now, and we are talking to you live from Burns, Oregon, and some very dramatic events now. So, Arun, give us your what's your understanding of the current situation out at the refuge?
So I went out last night, and I saw while Paul was getting his beauty sleep, and I saw these military-style convoys moving around town. I was taking photos of them and posting them to Twitter. I tried to go up to some of them, and they were pretty hostile. One of them yelling at me to back off. Clearly, there was something afoot. About 4 a.m., the FBI you know, it was clear that it was both state police and FBI. There's also all 36 county sheriffs have been mobilized for over the last month. There's also various unnamed law enforcement agencies out here because they didn't have insignias from any identifiable agency, but they did have these different types of markers to identify them to other law enforcement officers. So around 4 a.m., the FBI completely surrounded the compound. They have all the roads surrounded, going in and out of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. They haven't moved in yet. They've told them that anyone can leave. I'm not sure if they're arresting them as they leave. They say that they will search any vehicle and occupants who do leave. No one can go in. I think it's a little disturbing if they're actually letting people leave. You know, as well, there are some journalists there, and obviously the journalists shouldn't be arrested. And, you know, we did go down three times, and I think people often have some real misconceptions. You know, this was not explicitly a white supremacist movement, and I got, like, a pretty bizarre question, you know, like one reporter asked me, oh, you're a person of color, how did they treat you? And I was just like, you don't get what this is like. They actually are really nice to you. One, they had a very sophisticated media strategy, and two, they don't want to appear racist, so they're very polite and welcoming, nearly all of them. You know, but at the same time, a number of them said that they're willing to die. And, you know, we know for a fact that if this was a group of Muslims holed up there, you know, Obama would have probably sent in the drones a long time ago. And so, you know, the fact that they're treating them with kid gloves and have been treating them with kid gloves for the last month is, you know, I think an indication of a severe double standard that you can only be, and I'm not supporting the terrorist laws. I'm just pointing out the hypocrisy of the government that the only way you're a terrorist is if you have brown skin and your name is Muhammad.
Do we have any callers yet, Ross?
Paul, we have one caller. Let me pull him up. I believe he's there. It's Rick. Go ahead, Rick.
Go ahead, Rick.
Yes, I have a question for Arun Gupta. Two questions, I guess. The first is, what can the climate movement learn from what you've seen, which might be maybe an extreme edge of it, but I think there must be a learning experience here. And the second thing is, can you answer your own question that you raise of, or it wasn't a question, it was the issue you raise of what the climate movement needs to do to, or what can be done as a practical matter to not leave so many bystanders on the way to renewable energy that we end up defeating the movement itself?
What was the first question again? Sorry.
What lessons are there here from what's happened here?
The lessons, right. I think the lessons are, you know, like there are all sorts of different frames, like narrative frames you could use to look at the occupation. And one of them that I was looking at was similarities with Occupy Wall Street. You know, there were a lot of similar dynamics in which you were getting a lot of different groups and people coming in with different agendas, but they all supported the movement. You were also getting, frankly, a lot of fringe personalities. You know, it was looking like something that it could spread because they did have a lot of sympathy in Grant, Oregon. There were something like 100 people waiting to talk to the Bundys about setting up a committee of safety. But there were also key differences. There was a clear leadership. They had a very clear agenda. That was something that Occupy Wall Street lacked. And, of course, they also had guns and, you know, but they're at tapping into this kind of mythologized Western violence. And, you know, these narratives about the frontier and rugged individualism. But I think the fact of the matter that they had strategy and leadership is something that is sorely lacking on nearly all the left and much of the environmental movement as well. You know, the environment, especially the big environmental groups, they mistake messaging for strategy and PR spokespeople for leadership. That's not how you build movements. And in terms of the second part, you're saying something about renewable energy?
No, I was just saying you raised the issue during while I was listening on the phone about that these people who are, the jobs are leaving, you know, Harney County, they're leaving, you know, the Jordan Valley, and how there'll be a rush in to take the place of the vacuum, and that rush that will come in is going to be what happened here with the Bundys. There'll be right-wing extremists. There'll be other groups saying, here's how you have to do it. And the movement, I'm saying renewable energy, or basically the change from fossil fuels. How can we proceed and do what, you know, what needs to be done in making this change without leaving too many bystanders along the way that will end up basically making the change extremely difficult?
Okay, well, thanks very much for calling, Rick. We're going to have to leave the line open because we only have one and allow other people to call in. So, Arun, go ahead.
It's something Paul and I have been talking about, and it's just, I mean, for one, this whole issue of local control, you know, I understand that, but I think in this era of extreme climate change, you know, it's we're not just talking about climate change. We're also in the sixth great extinction, mass extinction, species extinction in Earth's history. And what you essentially need to do, I think, is to rewild, like, large areas of the entire North American continent to allow not just species but entire ecosystems to be able to migrate northward. Certainly not all of them can. But, you know, we have to view this as something as just like the patrimony for human generations, you know, hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of generations down the line. And, you know, I mean, frankly, it would mean, I think, a radical depopulation of much of the rural West, and that is not going to win any fans out here. Maybe there are ways that you can continue some sustainable, low-impact ranching and logging. I think it is possible to do. I've seen folks do it, been to farms where they've done low-impact ranching, cattle keeping, and, you know, you could probably certainly do some logging as well. But in terms of the economy, I'm not sure what there is to base it out here on other than tourism and then transfer of government dollars. But that essentially is what the economy is out here. You know, everyone knows right off the tip of their tongue that 40% of the workforce is employed in some sort of government job or another. You know, there's been 150 federal employees who haven't been able to go to work for a month here because, like all federal offices have been closed down. But you have all the various police services, and you have the state agencies, health care, you know, schools. So that is already sustaining a huge part of the population. And then, you know, you also do have significant tourism. But then, of course, you know, tourism has, you know, its issues with people driving hundreds of thousands and thousands of miles each just to go see some birds. You know, can we still afford to do that? So I don't think there's any real easy answers. I think it's answers that have to be done with the people who live here. They can't just be run roughshod over, and they can't just be ignored. But there's no simple solutions.
Well, you raised a whole lot of issues in one that's enough for about 5 or 10 programs here. I have my own views on a lot of what you said. I'm just going to sort of let that pass because our time is at a premium here. I know you may have to go here in a little bit. Just let us know when you do. But do we have another caller, Ross?
Yeah, we've got Lynn on the phone.
Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi. Yes, I have been interested in this. I'm, you know, environmentalist, but also I am a meat eater, and so I, you know, I don't like the fact that 95% of the meat in this country comes from these factory farms, and I think the ranchers are important, so I've been interested in what is really going on, and I have been a little disappointed with the mainstream media kind of trying to create animosity towards them and not giving us both sides of the story. And I'm not saying I support what they're doing, but I really question whether they're actually, you know, being victimized by the BLM and, you know, possibly, you know, they are trying to push them somehow off their land for some reason that is unknown to me. And I also wonder why people aren't paying attention to the fact that the government just released a new proposed set of rules that the Bureau of Land Management is allowed to frack on 600 million acres of federal land. And there's also one-third of our wildlife refuges in this country that are being drilled and mined. And these are issues to me that are very serious and very important. It seems to me that those are taking the, you know, they aren't in the forefront of the news, and to me those seem like very important issues.
Well, you know, there's a lot of paradoxes, contradictions, ironies in all this. One of them that Arun and I have been remarking on regularly is that, for one, the, you know, both of us have no great love for the FBI, given their dramatically negative impact on social movements over the past, you know, since they've been in existence, J. Edgar Hoover and after. But also, as you rightly point out, some of this is sort of taking attention away from the truly bad mismanagement, whether it's, you know, fracking, whether it's mining, whether it's oil drilling, opening up areas for all kinds of exploitation. Of course, Arun mentioned the historically role of the Forest Service in BLM in terms of massive over-harvesting of timber and such. And, of course, on the other side, you've got the people, you know, the Bundys and vast numbers of other people, you know, fairly large number of other people in the West, who, including a number of people we've talked to, who completely look at it absolutely differently. Like, there's two different realities here. They see the mismanagement being that not enough logs are able to flow. So you've got this same standoff that's been going on for decades, you know, since I was involved in the so-called forest or timber wars in the 80s and 90s, and it's just you know, the side, there's been really no resolution of that. But I think you bring up really important issues that we're not really able to look, you know, because of these polarizations, we're not able to really look at the reality. Arun, what's your take on Lynn's question?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not surprised that the BLM is doing that at all. It's horrendous. I'm also a meat eater, and I think there are very much sustainable ways to do it. To say you can't eat meat sustainably is just an ideology. If you're not looking at the actual material conditions, and it's a bogus ideology. But yeah, the factory farming is horrendous. I do not support it in the least. And you know, I think a good example is this Harney County Committee of Safety. Now they were the ones that the Bundy set it up, and they're talking about, oh, we're going to get the control back to the local people, and they're like, we're not going to, you know, just be overturning all these environmental laws. But I was looking through all their documents, and they did like come up with this model for what could be done in terms of ranching and timber, what they called at full capacity. And they estimated that Harney County could be bringing in 5 or 6 times the amount of revenue that it was. And so they were already thinking of just like, you know, total exploitation of the lands. And the problem is, you know, folks out here, even though they were they're at each other's throats, I think are all agree that it has to be resource exploitation. And I think what we need to be, you know, we need to be clear is like those days are over, frankly. Not
and
just
I,
here, but across
I agree
the
completely
planet.
With that. You know, I just, do they even have forest out there to cut?
Yeah, there's plenty of forest out here. We were driving through this gorgeous forest when we came across the police takedown of the Bundy.
Well, I think that the forest, the logging can't, I don't approve of any of that, and I don't know that it can be done sustainably because they, every time they say they are going to, they don't. But the ranching, I think, could be done sustainably, and I've done some research on that actually raising the cattle on grassland can be a carbon sink as opposed to mm-hmm. the factory farms, which put out huge greenhouse gases.
Uh-huh. Well, listen, thank you so much for calling, Lynn. Neither Arun nor I are in, by any stretch of the imagination, experts or even really fully informed about all the things that you're talking about, so I personally would hesitate. One thing I would say is that, you know, you mentioned factory farms, but, you know, there is a connection between grazing, wherever cattle ranching, wherever it's done, and what you call factory farming, because actually a lot of, you know, the rancher we talked to a couple days ago sells his, I forget what they are, 10-month or whatever, old calves to large feedlot operations where they get fattened up and then sold to market. So, you know, those feedlots are getting cows from all kinds of different operations. So there is a connection there that, you know, it's a system, and the system has to be looked at as a whole. But so, yeah, you raised a lot of good questions, but maybe we should give another caller a chance.
And I have to go. Thanks so much for having me on, Paul.
And thank you, Arun. And we look forward to hearing more reports because Arun spends a fair amount of his time in Portland now. Sorry, I didn't give you a heads up on that, Ross. Arun actually lives a part, or I don't know how much of the year, in Portland, and he lives in New York, and he spends a certain amount of time in Portland. He's here now. Anyway, he has an apartment back in New York, and we do appreciate his presence here, though, for his reporting. And you can go to the Raw Story and hear and read more of his reporting on this and other things. And so I'm here by myself now. I'm at the Silver Spur Motel in Burns, Oregon, talking about all these events that have been going on here for the past 3.5 weeks. If we have any other callers that want to talk about this, the number to call is 503 231-8187. And I'm speaking now with Ross Freeman Levin, my trusty engineer. Ross, do we have any other callers?
Yeah, you bet, Paul. We've got Sean on the line, and we've got one line open.
Okay, Sean, go ahead. Hello, Sean.
Hey, so I have one question, but since you guys were talking about the other things that the BLM and so forth does, is I just want to make people aware, since ironically it also is in a different part of Eastern Oregon, is that down in the Shawakan River Valley, which is one of the most beautiful places in Oregon, which is just east of or west of Paisley and Summer Lake area, the BLM has been in the process of a very large make-work project of cutting down very old growth, literally junipers in the area. I mean, throughout a very large area of that spot. Because they've used the argument as they're kind of a weed and they're not native, but actually they've been there for a very long time, otherwise the trees wouldn't be that old. But I came to find out, ironically, that I was down there camping last fall, and then on my way back home, I stopped at Oregon State Park on the John Day River, ironically, and came to find out, because it was a park that's newer, and a lot of the tables and fences and everything were new. Well, I came to find out, ironically, that they have worked a deal with the BLM, with the government, that juniper, the wood that's there, is juniper that comes from that harvesting. So, quite an irony.
Yeah, well, it's a complicated situation.
I just wanted to point that out, that there's this massive harvesting program going on, but then there's a program to filter it through Oregon State Parks. They're basically to find ways to use it to justify, I guess, you know, the project. But anyway, so real quickly, and I just wanted to hear this at the very beginning of the show, because I didn't even know this happened until last night. A friend told me. I hadn't been listening to the news. But you said that you guys came upon it late. Supposedly it sounded like you even literally were driving up on when the shooting happened. But you
said... No. In fact, I'm actually embarrassed to say that we came. We were about three or four cars back. We saw all these flashing lights, and we were running late trying to get to this this other meeting of the to form the Grant County Committee of Safety, where we're going the same direction that the Bundy crew was going to the same place.
Yeah.
And it looked like an accident up ahead, and we were basically, oh no, we're not going to get to our meeting, so we're kind of frustrated. And instead of, like, getting out and investigating and finding out that actually that was the story of the decade right in front of us, we turned around. And we could have actually come upon a shooting if we had been, you know, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes earlier, which we could have because we were running late. But that's that was pretty dramatic.
Right. My question is because I haven't even bothered to look at the mainstream media and anybody to see what they had to say. But since you guys are there, and I'm sorry Arun's not there, but you had specifically said that troopers were involved. Do you have any idea whether the shootout was between the FBI or state troopers?
I haven't even had time or the ability to really look up, and Arun is gone now, so he can't tell us what he learned. But I'm almost certainly there was FBI presence. I can't imagine there wasn't, and I don't know if it was a roadblock. I don't know I assume it must have been a roadblock. I don't know if they like tried to overtake them, but and I don't know who shot first. I mean,
well, it definitely sounds like something that was premeditated. They knew they were going.
Of course. I mean,
yeah, and
we knew they were going, but that's because we've been, you know, it's just an amazing scene here. You go to the bar and you find all these, you know, we've been talking to these quote right wing. I don't know if you know media people, you know, who have their own websites, who have their own like. Internet radio, and they're tight, you know, what they know what's going on, and some of them will actually talk to us and give us sort of background information. So yeah, we knew that the Bundys were going, so if we knew, of course the authorities knew that they were going over that, you know, which was kind of foolish on their part, since that was, you know, basically decapitated the leadership of this occupation, you know, so who knows what's going to happen to the rest of them.
Well, it's kind of interesting, and you know, the info that came in last night that I heard, that supposedly was out there, that the person who was killed, that supposedly he had his hands up, I mean, this is just, you know, who knows what the truth is ultimately, but that the person had his hands up and they still shot him anyway, or he's down on the ground and he was shot. You know, whether that's true or not, but the other part of it is that it was smart to decide to make this happen far away from the refuge instead of actually taking the whole thing on at the refuge.
Oh, that's true, too.
You know, I just found it that it's a big difference whether or not state troopers are involved or the FBI, because then it would kind of release the federal government from having been responsible in a shooting death. So that's just why I'm kind of curious. And obviously, I think it's going to be a while before we actually find out what the truth is, if we ever fully find it out.
Well, you know, it's interesting the things you brought up, because you know a lot of people, you know, on that side, on the, you know, the Bundy occupation side, have been, you know, emphasizing very strongly, oh, you know, it's not us that's, you know, we're, you know, people are accusing us of being violent and stuff. It's not us that's creating this atmosphere of violence. It's the FBI and the, you know, whatever.
Right.
And so, you know,
they showed up with the gun.
Initiate the shootout, you know, will be obviously there'll be a lot of different versions going out. Obviously people are going to spin their own story. But yeah, I mean, that is an important fact. I mean, you know, but what Arun said is that some of these people have said that they were willing to die. You know, there's speculation that one of the people captured, Ryan Blaine, I believe his name is, he was at the Bundy. A lot of these people were at the Bundy Ranch down in Nevada. So, you know, this is there's a continuity to this whole thing. But some of them, there's speculation that, you know, he wanted to, quote, die by government, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, some of these people might have, you know, such deep frustrations. You know, who knows? You
well,
know,
there's kind of the irony, and I'll just leave it this, is that, you know, they say here the government's the violent one, yet they show up with guns and make the statements that they're willing to die. And then, of course, you know, they want to try to, if they do, they want to then try to show that, see, the government is violent, yet they show up with guns and, you know, initiate the whole thing. And I hate to say this, but, you know, whoever was responsible and however it went down, the fact is they got what they came for because of what they expressed and the mere fact that they showed up with guns to begin with. So anyway, but thanks. Thanks for what
okay.
you're doing.
Okay, thanks, Sean. And do we have any other callers?
You bet we do. We've got another caller, Don.
Don, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Paul. Hey, nice for you guys to be out there and covering it. But and I agree with you is, you know, one thing is these guys are ignoring the Native American rights and the fact that they really do own the land. And so I didn't really like that they were ignoring this part of it. And but the other hand, like you said, Paul, you know, the federal government, the police have not been our friend for those of us on the left. And the alternative media, I think, has not been real, has been kind of hostile to these guys without taking into consideration the other point, is that those of us on the left are also in this battle with the police and the federal government and Homeland Insecurity. And you know, Chris Andre, she's been one of the main people really pushing this through. She had Mark Potek on Monday from the Southern Poverty Law Center. He's a lawyer. And he was really attacking him. And the thing is that that the Southern Poverty Law Center, they're an advisory for the Homeland Insecurity. They're on their board. So if you go and talk bad about Israel and what they're doing to the Palestinians, the Southern Poverty Law Center will come after you. And Mark Potek, he's on the radio telling Chris that, talking about the stolen lands from the Native Americans, but if you talk bad about Israel and them stealing land, he's one of the first people in his organization, one of the first people going on all the alternative media stations and the conservative, and attacking people who, you know, like these guys here. So it's there's a lot of bias, and I was a little disappointed that we weren't, those of us on the left and the media weren't more sympathetic to at least the point of what the history of Homeland Insecurity, the FBI, and what they've done to MOVE and people like that. And so I think there's a lot more people out here who are upset with the government that we should, on the left, at least take a look over on the other side and say, you know, why are you angry? We know why we're angry. Eric Garner, you know, he's trying to sell single cigarettes so people can quit smoking.
You bring up some, you know, some very troubling and interesting questions that I do think that people don't want to look at. Now, in terms of, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center, I think some of your points are valid. I think there's, you know, there's contradictions within the left the right, the center. You know, I think that we don't. We tend to like sort of look at the other side and sort of demonize it and look for sort of these easy analyses. And so obviously, you know, it's very frustrating. It's there's frustration in that they, you know, a lot of people were sort of cheering on, you know, the federal government to come in and and whatever, do violence to these people, and you know, no one wanted to see violence, but you have to also look at the, you know, you also have to look at the strange and bizarre ideologies that a lot of these people had, but you also have to look at them as human beings, and we spent time with them. I certainly wouldn't necessarily want to spend a lot of time with them, but there's in some ways, you know, more similarities between, you know, most Americans and them than between, say, I don't know, them and, I don't know, maybe the Paiutes, you know, as just sort of a radical statement. And just in terms of history, you know, obviously leaving aside, you know, for the sake of argument, African Americans who came here by force and were enslaved, and so are, you know, have a very different history. But those of us who are like settler colonists, you know, have, you know, in some ways, you know, structurally more in common with the Bundy crowd, you know, and that's an uncomfortable thing. I think we really have to look really hard at these things.
Yeah, in some ways, we have to see that the, like that guy they killed, his name was Robert. He's been on the radio a lot, and he was very articulate, and I thought some of his arguments were legitimate. On the other hand, this guy, Mark Potek, a lawyer from the Southern Poverty Law Center, when the shooting went down in Phoenix with James Lofton, 5 days later, Mark Potek was on ABC radio telling everybody he was a pervert. He was talking about a picture they found of him in a pair of colored underwear and just really attacking this kid who, for whatever reason he did, he's mentally ill. And this lawyer, he's an agitator, and I feel the Southern Poverty Law Center is one of the biggest agitators we have in America. They're out here fighting for Israel. They're not fighting for the African-Americans in the South who are hung. They went down, you know, it's supposed to be called the Southern Negro Law Center. They went down there with their money and their New York lawyers and said, if you want our money, you're going to have to change it to poverty because that'll include us. And so I'm really disappointed, Chris Andre, and thanks for talking about it today.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling. And, you know, I don't want to disparage other KBOO talk show people on the radio. We're all, you know, doing the best we can. But I think criticism is a healthy thing. So I think it's good to raise all these kind of issues. It would be good if we were able to have more time to really get more deeply into them. But, you know, I wish Arun was here to talk about this because, you know, he has some really interesting points about the you know, some people's tendency to sort of make these broad sort of conspiratorial on both the right and the left, these broad conspiratorial, because certainly associations, you know, saying that just sort of jumping to conclusions about what people's associations are, and certainly the people, the Bundy crowd does that. I mean, boy, we sort of were wanting to sort of like make a, you know, ask them, you know, what their views on all the various conspiracy theories out there, because they're sure full of them. You know, I think they have a very, you know, insular worldview, and, you know, in some ways maybe this whole incident is actually bringing things out that need to come out. Unfortunately, not necessarily in the, you know, the healthiest way, because as I mentioned, I don't know if it got on the air, but I mentioned in an interview I did for the news on KBOO the other day that, you know, there really is, you know, and Jessica Campbell from the Rural Organizing Project made this point on Joanne Hardesty's show last week, that this community, there's, you know, it's to some extent being torn at the seams, where people are really sort of going, their views are bringing, it's almost like, you know, when civil wars happen to some degree, and it's a community that's really had suffered a lot and needs healing rather than these kind of violent situations, but who knows where it's all going. Do we have any other callers, though, Ross? How much time do we have left, by the way?
This is it, Paul. We got to sign off and thank all our listeners.
Okay. Well, I hope this has been valuable to people. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO. This is Paul Rowland from Burns, Oregon, at the Silver Spur Motel.
Don't take your guns to town. He laughed and kissed his mom and said, you're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as quick and straight as anybody can. But I wouldn't shoot without a cause, I'd gun nobody down. But she cried again as he rolled away. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town. He sang a song as on he rode, his guns hung at his hips. He rode into a cattle town.
On Monday, February 15th, at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will air a Valentine's Day special to bring to light the fact that, because of incarceration, many people are separated from their friends, family, and lovers on Valentine's Day. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out, or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our email address is kboppc@gmail.com and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on February 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture in Portland. Dr. Mutulu Shakur was one of the founders of the Black Acupuncture Advisory Association in North America and the Harlem Institute of Acupuncture. Incarcerated for 30 years, Mutulu and his legal team are seeking community and financial support to fight his imprisonment. A group of licensed acupuncturists and massage therapists are offering treatments to our community as a fundraiser. Again, that's of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture, 436 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the